available on digital media, iTunes podcast, smartphone apps, and from the online website. This is Outlook, the talking newspaper for Coventry.
Hello and welcome from me, Ashley Haywood, to this week's Outlook. This one's been recorded on Wednesday the 4th of February. Coming up today, we hear about the village of Priors Hardwick and are updated on Coventry's Very Light Railway project. We get the second part of Catherine Robinson's life-changing injury and have a feature on Ravel's one-act fantasy opera. Finally, we accompany Dave on a visit to the excellent Coventry Music Museum. All of this, plus your sports news, the post bag, upcoming events, and an update from the Hub. But first, we have the week's local news, read today by Peter and Elaine.
Outlook News.
Coventry's nighttime economy has been awarded an international accreditation, recognising the city as a safe destination after dark. The city has been given purple flag status, highlighting the city centre, Earlston High Street, and the Casbah in Primrose Hill Street, as providing a safe, entertaining, diverse and enjoyable night out. The local authority said the city was visited in November by independent assessors from the Association of Town Centre Management, who spent a full day and night in the city centre and visited pubs, bars, restaurants and nightclubs. Joanne Glover, Chief Executive of Coventry BID, said, "The safety of visitors to the city centre is our highest priority, so it is fantastic to have received a purple flag recognition after many years of hard work across the city." Coventry City Council said it had worked with the Business Improvement District and police in a bid to ensure positive nighttime experiences in the city centre. This included relaunching the Ask for Angela scheme, providing a way for people feeling vulnerable in a bar or venue to discreetly ask for help from staff. As part of the scheme, 150 people completed training over the past 12 months. Other work included licensing and compliance activity, taxi safeguarding checks, and installing 100 public defibrillators and bleed kits over the past 3 years. In this time, the BID has also purchased 200,000 safety items for venues to distribute free of charge, including drink-safe anti-spiking covers, bottle toppers, and drink-safe testing strips to allow venues to spot-check if a drink has been spiked. The council said its licensing team worked with Coventry BID on the Best Bar None scheme, highlighting venues which excel in safety training and customer experience. Taxi marshals have been introduced in the city centre to help people get home safely, and Coventry BID Street Patrol team has expanded its service to cover the evening to deter crime and antisocial behaviour. Council Abdul Salam Khan, deputy leader of Coventry City Council, said, "We want our city centre to feel safe and welcoming, and I'm grateful for the efforts of the council, police, BID officers and Coventry Street pastors, as well as so many hospitality venues in helping achieve this. The assessment process helped us showcase the city's many fantastic venues, and the feedback we received from the assessment team was overwhelmingly positive."
Coventry City Council needs to be doing the right thing in the right way when it comes to disposing of some of the thousands of museum pieces currently kept in storage. That was the message from Councillor Roger Bailey at a meeting of the Communities and Neighbourhood Scrutiny Board, where officers produced a list of items no longer wanted. A report considered by councillors at their meeting explained that the City Council has collected a wide range of historical and artistic artefacts over time through a combination of statutory archiving, donations and gifts, bequests, loans, commissions and purchases. In Coventry's case, there are more than 300,000 listed items. The report explains most of these are on loan, entrusted to the care of Culture Community Trust by way of a funding and management agreement, and principally housed at either the Coventry Transport Museum, the Herbert Art Gallery Museum, or other ancillary stores. For one or more reasons, the museums may periodically review arrangements and propose to dispose of certain items from the collections. It's important to note that disposal in this context means deaccessioning or transferring out of the collection rather than disposal in the waste sense. Officers explained that priority will be given to retaining the item within the public domain, and it will therefore be offered to other accredited museums. If, though, after a period of at least 2 months, there have been no expressions of interest, items could be offered to other interested individuals and organisations. The majority of the items on the list are glassware or ceramics, many coming from large collections that have been donated to the city. Others include an earthenware storage jar uncovered during the Godiva Street culvert works in 1968, and a small medicine bottle found in Potter's Green. Councillor Bailey said, "It is really important that we actually have transparency so members of the public can actually see what's going on. Many of these items are from collections and we need to be careful what we do. They're coming from some famous local names such as Cashies. We need to be seen to be doing the right thing for the right reasons, and by bringing it to scrutiny we now should have that transparency."
Coventry schools are among those leading the way when it comes to phone-free classrooms, according to the City Council's Cabinet Member responsible for education across the city. Councillor Dr. Kindy Sandu said work started long before a recent letter to schools from the Education Secretary Bridget Phillipson, which said children should not be using their phones during lessons, breaks and lunchtime, with Ofsted now monitoring how schools implement the policy. Councillor Sandu said, "We started looking at this last summer. We have what we call a Family of Schools partnership, and it is all about working in collaboration with the schools. We went to Westwood School last July and spoke to the head teacher and the chief executive. They had introduced a ban the previous September, so they talked to us about it, explained to us the kind of challenges that they faced and that they chose to do to it because they wanted kids to focus on learning. They suggested that we spoke to a number of pupils, which we did, and the first we spoke to said it was about trust, which led to the head teacher allowing pupils to give phones to their mentors. The young people we spoke to talked about how they didn't like it at first, but what they found was that lessons were less disruptive. The teachers did not have to tell them to put their phones away, and they also said there were fewer fights being instigated because kids weren't recording. But the thing that really touched me was that they said they were freer to talk. Because there were no phones, they could say what they wanted to say without the fear of them being recorded." Councillor Sandu added that some children said they didn't even bother taking this phone to school, and that when they got home they didn't look at it as much as they used to, and talk to their parents more. "As Cabinet Member, I don't think I could sleep well at night if I'm not doing anything to help young people and children. This is one of the reasons why we've been pushing this, but we want to work collaboratively. And one of the things I've said to the officers is that I want to get young people involved in how we design the campaign. Speaking to these young people made me think that, actually, this is the right way to do it."
More than one in five Coventry children are not fully vaccinated against measles, mumps and rubella by the age of five. Figures show that the vaccine rate in the city, that is, the proportion of children who have had both doses of the MMR vaccine by age five, stands at just 78.9%. In Warwickshire, where the vaccine rate stands at 88%, there have been fewer than 10 cases of measles since 2023. But 47 cases have been reported in Coventry over the same time period. The UK recently lost its elimination status for the virus. The country was first declared measles-free in 2017, but the World Health Organization reduced this status in 2019, only to return it in 2021, mainly thanks to social distancing during the pandemic. But outbreaks began again in 2023 and intensified throughout 2024. In England alone, there were nearly 3,000 laboratory-confirmed cases of measles in 2024. And on that basis, WHO and the UK Health Security Agency said that the virus had re-established endemic transmission, costing the UK its measles elimination status. This all comes as vaccination uptake has slumped to its lowest level in a decade in England. As of last summer, only 91.8% of five-year-olds in England had received one dose of the MMR jab, and 83.7% had been protected by both doses. WHO says you need a 95% vaccine coverage to achieve herd immunity. But in some parts of the UK, vaccination rates are much lower. In Birmingham, a centre for a 2024 outbreak, just 75% of five-year-olds had received both MMR doses. And as we said, Coventry's figure is below 80%. From this year, the MMR jab has been replaced by the MMRV vaccine, which also offers the same protection as MMR, but also covers chickenpox. Dr. Vanessa Saliba, consultant epidemiologist at UKHSA, said infections can return quickly when childhood vaccine uptake falls. Measles elimination is only possible if all eligible children receive both their MMRV doses before going to school. Older children and adults who miss vaccination must catch up. The NHS is making vaccination easier, including offering the second MMRV dose earlier at a new 18-month appointment to boost uptake and to support elimination goals.
Hospital patients undergoing lengthy procedures in Coventry are being offered virtual trips via headsets to the beach, the forest or mountains to help alleviate pain and anxiety during treatment. The trial is focused on those undergoing interventional radiology procedures, some of which can take up to 4 hours. University Hospitals Coventry and Warwickshire NHS Trust said the equipment also provided a meditative soundtrack. The headset can only be used by patients needing certain treatments of minimally invasive procedures lasting longer than 20 minutes. Specialist interventional radiographer Leah Simeone said there had been positive feedback so far. People often come a bit worked up, and that anxiety just increases the longer the procedure goes on, and we find it helps to manage that. She said patients with certain illnesses experienced higher levels of pain after lying down flat during treatment. She said the trial could even help reduce the amount of room time, sedation and radiation time they use in the long term. Vascular patients tend to have cramping type pain in their lower limb, and lying down flat on the couch just makes that pain worse. It just turns into a numbness that then turns into an ache and excruciating pain. So having the headset helps them to keep that distraction up and on the treatment table for longer. So far, some patients have asked for less top-up sedation, but more patients are needed for the trial to get more data. The scheme is not available to those under 18, or, understandably, to those with a history of vertigo, dizziness, or epilepsy.
A calm and approachable hospital ambulance liaison officer, or HALO, for West Midlands Ambulance Service has won an award from the hospital in Coventry where he works. The Making a Difference Award is a monthly recognition programme celebrating individuals who go above and beyond to enhance patient experience, support colleagues and strengthen collaboration across services. University Hospitals Coventry and Warwickshire NHS Trust named Mark Hayes as their latest Making a Difference Award winner for his exceptional contribution to patient care. And he was presented with his award by UHCW's Deputy Chief Executive Officer, Susan Rollison. As a HALO, Mark plays a vital role in supporting timely and safe ambulance handovers, helping to free ambulance crews to respond to emergencies while maintaining strong relationships between the two organisations. The nomination praised Mark's consistent demonstration of partnership and described him as calm, approachable and solution-focused even during times of high pressure. It highlighted his clear and effective communication in helping to de-escalate challenging situations, encouraging teamwork and ensuring that patients, ambulance crews and emergency department colleagues all felt heard and supported. Mark said, "I'm extremely grateful to receive this award, but it comes as a bit of a shock. Ultimately, it's a whole team effort and I couldn't do what I do without the support of everyone at the hospital."
NHS bosses in Coventry and Warwickshire are urging people to only order the medicines they need, as they claim wasted medication is costing about £13.3 million a year in the county. They have begun a new campaign to try to cut the number prescribed unnecessarily on repeat prescriptions, and say about 1.6 million items are wasted annually. The main way people can play their part is by checking the medicines they have at home when they order their repeat prescriptions and only order what they need, a spokesperson for the area's Integrated Care Board said. They also urge people to give any unused medicines to a pharmacist so they do not end up polluting rivers and waterways. The ICB spokesperson added that many people believe they must keep ordering medicine to get it in the future, but this was not true, and they could pause and then still order it again. People can also help by checking prescription bags before they leave the pharmacy to make sure it contains nothing extra. An item can only be returned and reused if it is returned before it leaves the pharmacy.
Coventry's two universities are celebrating success in world rankings, with one climbing to a higher position than ever before. The University of Warwick, based in Coventry, has moved up 5 places in the latest QS World University Rankings Europe to a record high of 17th. Coventry University, meanwhile, ranked 193rd out of almost 1,000 institutions. This is the second year that that institution has made the top 200. Professor Michael Scott, Pro Vice Chancellor at the University of Warwick, said, "Warwick is a proudly international and a proudly European university. We're a founding member of the Guild of European Research Universities, a proactive group of 23 universities strengthening the voice of universities in Europe, and a founding member of the Utopia University Alliance, a dynamic network of 10 European universities and 6 global partners working towards closer research collaboration and greater student opportunity." Professor Stuart Croft, Vice-Chancellor and President, said, "Achieving our highest ever place in the QS Europe rankings recognises the world-class research and teaching that we offer at Warwick." Professor John Latham, CBE, Vice-Chancellor and Group CEO of Coventry University, said, "To maintain our position in the top 200 universities in Europe, with more than a third more institutions competing this year, is a remarkable achievement. It speaks volumes about the dedication and excellence of our colleagues, and I want to thank them for their commitment to delivering an outstanding learning experience and impactful research. Our gold rating in the Teaching Excellence Framework reflects the exceptional quality of our teaching and student experience, complementing the global recognition we're now achieving through these rankings."
Perhaps the most infamous of all city residents has inspired a local spirit distiller to give a classic cocktail a distinctive Coventry twist. The tale of Lady Godiva is one every city schoolchild learns. the greedy Earl Leofric, who wanted to tax his people more, and the heroic Lady Godiva, his good wife, who was prepared to bear all to save the people from having to pay more. But the third character of the tale, a man who didn't listen when residents were ordered to avert their eyes while Lady Godiva rode through the city streets naked on horseback, has gone down in history too. Peeping Tom. Not only are his actions remembered in the city through statues and the famous Broadgate clock, his very name went down in history as an expression for a voyeuristic peeper. A local distiller has taken this infamy and created a spirit known as Peeping Tom Gin, and the Warwickshire Gin Company has created a cocktail called Peeping Tom Collins. Its website states, "Do you know the story of Peeping Tom? The legend of Lady Godiva's infamous ride through Coventry has been told and retold for centuries, so the facts are a little sketchy, but we won't let that get in the way of a good story. So we've taken our signature core of botanicals and gently spiced them up with star anise, nutmeg and cinnamon. Serve with Indian tonic over ice and garnish with a slice of lemon and a cinnamon stick for a touch of seasonal sass." The company has a host of other spirits linked with local history, including one which takes inspiration from the region's connections with elephants, and another which is a tribute to one of the region's most successful boxers, Randolph Turpin.
Coventry Food Bank has marked its 15th anniversary with a special visit from the city's Lord Mayor. Founded in 2011, Coventry Food Bank has grown from a small community initiative into a vital service supporting thousands of local people each year. Over the 15 years, the organisation has worked in partnership with local churches, schools, businesses and referral agencies to provide emergency food parcels and compassionate support to those in crisis. It partners with care professionals to identify people in crisis and to issue them with a food bank voucher. This voucher is then used at a food bank centre where it can redeem for 3 to 5 days of emergency food. Councillor Rachel Lancaster toured the food bank facilities at the Halo Centre in Binley and spoke with staff, volunteers and clients. She said, "For 15 years this centre has been a place of hope, dignity and community. The support provided to people across Coventry, often at the most difficult moments in their lives, cannot be overstated. Their commitment ensures that no one in our city is left to struggle alone, and that is something truly worth honouring. You are a testament to what Coventry stands for, solidarity, kindness and resilience." Tony Lee was first brought into contact with the food bank in 2012 after a spell in hospital with septic arthritis, which left him unable to work. He said, "I was so short of money, the food bank was a lifeline for me during that time. And when I was well enough, I started volunteering. A couple of years after that, I became employed as a member of staff." Tony was recently the face of the Where's Tony Food Bank Christmas campaign, which raised more than £15,000. Project manager Hugh McNeil sought the help of the charity after being left penniless following the collapse of his restaurant business in 2013. He joined the team and has been instrumental in building the food bank's Pathfinder Outreach project, which has reduced the number of local food bank users from 30,000 to 21,000 a year. He said, "My life was transformed through charity, and that's why I try to give back as much as I can. I thought I was going to open a restaurant and get paid money for giving people food, but now I'm in a situation where I'm getting paid and I'm giving people food, but for them, it's for free."
Dog barking has sparked thousands of complaints to Coventry City Council over the past 5 years. Nearly 2,000 reports have been logged since 2020, highlighting an ongoing noise nuisance in Coventry. In 2025, the City Council received 290 complaints about barking dogs. Although barking is normal for dogs, when it becomes prolonged, it can indicate stress and impact their well-being. A spokesman for puppies.co.uk said, "Dogs do not just bark for no reason, and it is their main way of communicating with us. It may mean your pet is excited, anxious, fearful, bored, or even warning someone off. If your dog barks when you are not at home, it may be a sign of distress at being left alone. It can quickly lead to problems with neighbours if it happens regularly. You should not leave your dog alone for hours on end. After all, they need opportunities to exercise, go to the toilet, and spend time with people. You should also be concerned if you observe other signs of distress, such as howling, going to the bathroom indoors, disruptive behaviour, trembling, pacing, or whining. Barking may also be a response to fear, such as being approached by another dog or person, or even feeling trapped without a way to escape. You can help by introducing your dog to new people and pets slowly, in calm surroundings, and by giving praise when your dog stays relaxed. Some dogs may bark to protect their territory, and understandably this can be frustrating. But the good news is you can reduce this type of barking by using treats or toys to distract your dog, or sending them to another area of the house when someone approaches. Dogs are intelligent and active animals, and if they do not get enough stimulation, they may bark out of boredom. Just like children, when they do not have enough to do, they may make noise about it, so regular exercise, a variety of toys and activities can help keep them entertained. It is important to remember that not all barking is negative. In some cases, it is simply excitement. A high-pitched bark with a wagging tail usually means your dog is happy. Keeping to a regular routine for meals, walks, and play can reduce overexcited barking and help your dog feel more settled.
A mum who set up a friendship group for single parents has said she is delighted to see it grow to thousands of members and become nationwide. Chrissy Edwards from Coventry set up Single Parents Friendship and Community UK, which now has 4,200 members as it prepares to celebrate its first birthday this weekend. Miss Edwards said she had wanted to set up a community for single parents who are struggling with isolation and need those friendships to build themselves a village. "I have no other single parent friends really around me," she explained, "but now I've met some of my best friends through this group." SPFC's online presence includes a website and Facebook group. Members chat via WhatsApp communities, which include different groups such as a Send Parents Chat, Local Mums and Widows group. Members also meet at events, and at the weekend a group went on a walk at Wrighton Pools. Members have nights out and meet for family events such as walks and camping. Events attract people from other areas such as Brighton, Leicester and Derby, but members also branching off and hosting local events, Miss Edwards explained. "It's become a community in your pocket. It's amazing because it's nationwide," she said, adding it had grown legs and spread rapidly. At the last weekend, there were also SPFC activities in Leeds and Oldham. SPFC is now registered as a community interest company, and it was not for profit, she said. It will mark its birthday with a party, including a band, children's entertainment, and a photo booth.
Dippy the Diplodocus is to spend another year in Coventry after the exhibit's residency in the city was extended due to its popularity, said organisers. The 26-metre replica dinosaur skeleton arrived at the Herbert Art Gallery and Museum in 2023, but now a 3-year loan from London's Natural History Museum has been extended until February 2027. With the museum saying, "The nation's favourite dinosaur had captured the imagination of hundreds of thousands of visitors to the Coventry venue." Dippy has been a huge hit for visitors of all ages over the last 3 years, said Margarita Nugent at CV Life. She said the exhibit had helped cement the Herbert's reputation as a must-see venue in the West Midlands. The 292-piece replica was unveiled at the London Museum in 1905, and its display had been a wow moment for many children drawn to the exhibition during its 110-year run. In 2018, Dippy was taken on a UK tour, with locations reporting an influx of visitors, which became known as the Dippy effect. In Coventry, Dippy is credited with bringing in about 500,000 visitors to the Herbert over 3 years. An evaluation by Durnin Research estimated the attraction brought £2.1 million to the city's visitor economy between February 23 and February 25. The Herbert has held dinosaur-themed events alongside the exhibition, which have proved popular with families. These included a Doze Under Dippy overnight experience and the Brick Dinos exhibition, which included Lego dinosaur sculptures. Nugent said the extension would provide more opportunities to inspire and educate local families, and the museum was looking forward to making the most of these extra 12 months. Dr. Alex Birch, Director of Public Programmes at the National History Museum, said, "It's been fantastic to see the success of Dippy at Coventry's Herbert. We know that biodiversity is under threat, and the planet is facing a crisis. Dippy has the ability to capture people's imagination. Through this extended stay, we hope the nation's favourite dinosaur can encourage even more people to care about the natural world, as well as bringing further economic benefit to Coventry."
Outlook News.
And a big thank you to our newsreaders, Peter and Elaine. Now, sunrise will now be at 7:45 and sunset at 16:54. That's 6 minutes to five in old money. Oh, and I've got one announcement at the shop. There's a sale of DVDs. Now, in this week, you can go to the shop, and DVDs are £3 for £1. Sounds very good. And box sets, £3 for £5. And children's, you can get £5 for £1.50. Can't say fairer than that. So lots of DVDs on offer at the in the shop. Now I'm delighted to say Hugh's here for an update from the Hub.
Thank you very much indeed. A little bit of sad news to start. Many of you out there will remember Gary Kennedy, one of our long-standing service users, who's a very funny man. He moved away from Coventry a few years ago, and went up into Lincolnshire, but we had news last week that he passed away. His funeral we have a date for, which is the 24th of February, which I think is a Friday. It's not a Friday, it's a Tuesday. What we don't have actually is a location, and that location is either going to be somewhere up in Lincolnshire, or it could very well be in Coventry, because a lot of Gary's family are here in Coventry. So we don't know yet. We'll get more details. If you're interested in attending Gary's funeral, do let us know, and we'll do our best to help you do that. Now, I had a couple of interesting meetings in the last couple of days. This morning, indeed, as I speak to you, I was talking to the West Midlands Fire Service, and particularly their fire prevention service. So they do a safe and well programme. They'll undertake visits and what have you with people. Now, actually, we're going to be working a bit more closely with them, and we're going to get some training ourselves in order to make referrals. They know that people with sensory impairments, both sight and hearing loss, are at greater risk should there be a fire at their property, so that they will come and freely give advice. Now, we're going to just work on them a bit with that to help them refine their message, but if you feel that you would be interested in receiving a visit from some firefighters who will tell you a bit more about how to make things safer at home, then do let us know. It won't happen immediately, but we can start to make referrals soon. We're going to be working with them quite a lot, training them about what some of the requirements that visually impaired people need. They'll be training us. And my good colleagues here do not yet know, but will also be submitting regular little pieces that we can plug into the Outlook programme from the fire service, just with little nuggets of advice. So that will be a regular thing in the future, going forward, as they say, in corporate land. I also had a very interesting meeting with another charity, the Coventry and North Warwickshire Prostate Cancer Support Group. Now, prostate cancer checking now is not done, shall we put this, digitally. It is now it's a blood test where they check your PSA levels in certain very clever ways. Now, we're hoping that we might have a they might do a session here of where they take blood tests for people. And we know that you good folk out there, you chaps especially, well, in particularly in terms of prostate cancer, it's only you chaps, but chaps especially, you're not very good at going to the doctors or whatever. So this is a really good way. If you're over 40, you should get one of these blood tests, because the earlier they catch anything, and these tests will sort of flag up if there's any elevated risk, rather than tell you that you have anything horrible like prostate cancer, but it just means that you can that any treatment or investigations, and then if necessary treatments, can start much, much earlier, with a much better outcome. Prostate cancer is one of those diseases where actually you can live, you know, with it until you die of something else, frankly, mostly. So, but the sooner it's caught and can be treated, the better. So we're looking at a date, possibly in June, where they'll set up, there'll be phlebotomists, or, you know, blood takers set up here at the Vision Hub, and we'll be doing some blood tests. Now, they charge for this service. It's about £25, I think. But we are looking to get some funding to see if we can get you guys done for free. So if you're interested, again, I'd really quite like to know. We're particularly looking to get into the Afro-Caribbean communities as well with this, because the risk of prostate cancer amongst that, and indeed the South Asian communities, are much, much greater, weirdly. It's about twice the risk of contracting prostate cancer is twice what it is in the white British population, for some reason. We don't know why particularly, but there we are. So if you're interested in that, I'm quite keen that everybody, to be honest, you know, gets all these health checks done. Last year when we had our open day, for example, we had the bowel cancer screening service come and have a stand with us. We know that people with visual impairments do not access these tests and what have you as readily or as easily as other people. So we'll try and make it as accessible as possible through us and through the people that we work with. But certainly get yourself tested if you can. We will be publicising this as and when it takes place. As I say, we're trying to find funding to be able to offer some free tests as well, and possibly transport on the day. Last year, you may remember, in May, we had a fantastic evening down at the Willenhall Social Club. It was stars in their eyes, really. It was tribute bands. We had Tom Jones and Elton John. Yeah, I mean, not actually them, but people who were pretending to be them, but pretending very well to be them. And we were hoping to be able to do it again this year, but alas, the wonderful chap who organises is he's not been very well. He's not been very well for a number of months. So we finally found out yesterday that the event is certainly not going to happen this year, but we are looking hopefully for next year, give him a bit of time to recover. Whatever you had penciled down for May in terms of the Willen Hall event, unpencil. You can get your eraser out and scrub it away. Only one other thing to point out is that the week after next, which is half term week, I'm not going to be here, so, and Chris is going to take over, but I will be here next week to remind you, and if you need me at all the week after next, well, frankly, you can't have me. So that's it. Thank you very much.
Are you going anywhere nice?
No, my husband is retiring.
Oh.
And it's half term, and I've got the kid at home, so just staying at home and having a bit of a relax, and frankly, using up a bit of my holiday entirely. So there we are.
Thanks. Sarah's here now with the sports news.
Well, hello there, lovely, lovely listeners, and welcome to sport. Now, I should start this recording probably by saying those of you of a depressive nature would probably do best to fast forward through the first few minutes where I round up the local sport. Right. Here we go with that warning. Well, on Saturday, Coventry City travelled down to London to play Queen's Park Rangers, QPR to its friends, on the back of their 2-1 defeat by Norwich. Now, this was billed as a must-win game because, well, our away form of late has been dire. And our lead at the top of the championship had been trimmed to 3 points, though still with a healthy goal difference, which could make a difference. Well, it all looked so good because in the 53rd minute, Josh Eccles put us ahead, somewhat against the run of form, I have to say. But sadly, Queen's Park Rangers scored in about the 63rd, and again within 10 minutes, and that was the final score, 2-1. So we're still top of the league, but I'm sorry, you're not getting the song this week because it is only on difference. Now, this is ahead of the game on Saturday, which is at the CBS Arena. I believe it's a 3 o'clock kickoff. Although ALEXA tells me 3:01, so I don't know, but it's 3 o'clock to all of its friends. And that is against Oxford City, who we recently drubbed in, I think it was an early round of the FA Cup, 6-2 at home. Come on, City, I'll take 1-0. But then, a week on Monday, we've got a top of the table clash, yes, another one, at home to Middlesbrough, who we are currently tied with. So that should be a very interesting match. Now, also on the road this weekend was Stratford Town, but sadly they had no luck, coming back on the wrong end of the defeat by Worcester City. Now, Cov Rugby Club were playing at home, so surely they would make me feel better. They were leading at half time 14-12, but then when I checked the full time score, they'd lost 14-19 to Chinner. Going into that match, Cov were fifth in the champ and Chinner were sixth, but now Chinner are fifth and Cov are sixth. Oh well. Now, moving on to warmer climes and more cheerful results, with the Australian Open tennis, I want to say a huge congratulations to Neil Skupski, who with his new, this was only their second tournament, partner Christian Harrison of the United States, took the title in the men's doubles, beating an Australian pair, My gosh, I bet that was popular in Melbourne. Just to tell you about the women's and the men's. Well, the women's was won by Elena Rybakina, who won, or Rybakina. Depending on who you listen to, it's a different pronunciation. The Russian-born Kazakhstani, well, who won Wimbledon, I believe it was 4 years ago. She beat Irina Sarapenko, the world's number one by a long way. Now, the men's was really thrilling, and it was my pleasure to listen to it, and the semi-final. The semi-final saw Novak Djokovic go into the final as the oldest ever man to play in an open tennis final at 38. And he faced a younger opponent, 22-year-old Carlos Alcaraz. So this was going to be a record breaker, no matter actually how you looked at it, because it would either be won by the oldest man ever, or Alcaraz, this would complete his career Grand Slam, which meant he'd won the Australian, the French, Wimbledon and the American Opens, you know, the four big majors, and he is the tender age of 22. Well, it all looked really good for us Novak supporters. He absolutely tore into Alcaraz to take the first set. But sadly, I believe age really did affect his energy levels. And Carlos Alcaraz ran out the winner by 3-1. 22, and it's about your 7th major title. Cool, where did I go wrong? And now, moving on. I told you last week that the Winter Olympics start on February the 6th. Well, that's the opening ceremony. I mean, actually, curling started on the 4th, but we'll move on from that. So I thought I'd better tell you a little bit about the Winter Olympics. So the 2026 Winter Olympics are with us, and this year is the 25th of them. I won't say running of them, because they don't really run on snow. Well, the Nordic skiers do, but anyway. They start on Friday the 6th of February, and they last until the 22nd, which, though I haven't done my calculations, is usually a Sunday. And this time they're taking place in Milano Cortina, roughly round the Milan area for thee and me, which means they're in British time, almost. There's 1 hour difference, but at least it means not having to get up at silly o'clock. Now, there are 16 different events, though each is split into many groups. And this includes one new event of mountaineering. And they are pleased to announce that the vast majority of events are gender balanced. Unfortunately, Nordic skiing is still men only. I believe Nordic skiing is the one where you ski for hell for leather over a distance and then you shoot, but it may not be. And of course, this is all pushed very much by Kirsty Comtry, the IOC's new president. Now, rather excitingly, though with a word of caution, GB are set to have their best ever medals haul. You may remember of late we have rarely got more than one or two medals, and some Winter Olympics we've come away with no medals. In fact, our record medal haul is 5, but this time they've set us a target of between 3 and 7. And I do know that we're tipped to do rather well in one of the women's snowboarding events. I think it's at the half pipe, but I don't really know what I'm on about. The men's bobsleigh, although that was slightly hindered by our driver being disqualified for drugs, misdemeanour, I'll leave it at that, and the men's skeleton, which is that one where they run at high speed and throw themselves onto a tea tray and then manoeuvre down the bobsleigh rink and hope for the best. Anyway, I look forward to talking more about the Winter Olympics and bringing you all about GB's medal haul. And that has been it for sport this week. So have a very good weekend and a great week next week. And don't have nightmares about local sport anyway. Bye.
Well, I think I'd rather use a tea tray for scones and a pot of tea. I wouldn't fancy hurtling downhill very quick on one of those. Now here's Dave with your postbag.
This is Postbag. Join in the discussion.
Hello and welcome to your postbag. We begin with a comment from Graham arising from Sue's item about Christmas carols.
Listening to Sue Parker's item about carols which weren't actually written about Christmas got me thinking about the East 17's pop record, Stay Another Day. Now, I don't listen to lyrics very often on a record unless I can't understand what's made it so popular. But I listened to the lyrics of East 17's Stay Another Day, and I cannot work out why it's classed as a Christmas record. There's no reference to Christmas in it at all. I know it originally came out around Christmas time, but that doesn't necessarily make it a Christmas record. My point is, it's too good of a record to only be played at Christmas.
Thank you, Graham. I like singing A Winter's Tale by David Essex, which seems to be associated with Christmas. It's a lovely song written by Mike Batt and Tim Rice. Mike Batt wrote the Womble songs. My youngest son Graham says A Winter's Tale's better than A Wombling Merry Christmas. Tell us what music you like. And just after Christmas, Elizabeth went on the mince pie special on a steam train on the Battlefield line near the site of the Battle of Bosworth from Shackerston Station.
Hi everyone. The raving report today is from a super day out taking a steam train journey, which is organised by the Battlefield line. It was known as the Mince Pie Special. On the way to Shackerston, we passed through Fenny Drayton, where George Fox was born in 1624. George was the religious leader who was the founder of the Quakers. An impressive memorial stands in his honour. He was originally a shoemaker's apprentice. A Puritan by upbringing, George made several missionary journeys abroad, notably to North America in 1671. He was frequently imprisoned for his beliefs. His best known work is his journal in 1674. Whilst we were in the museum at the railway station, we were reliably informed that there is a resident ghost who is in the habit of tapping you on the shoulder from time to time. The poor guy was run over by a train whilst carrying water over the line in Victorian times. The guy who told us this had indeed been tapped on the shoulder. I commented on how the Victorian station evoked memories of Charles Dickens' novel, The Signalman. Talking of years gone by, King Edward VII was in the habit of taking his mistress, Lily Langtry, to this very station when he visited Gopsall Hall. This is now a glamping site, apparently.
The sound from yesteryear. The chugging of the steam train. You go back to another era. The chugging of the train. It takes you back in time. gathering speed. Gathering speed.
Aww, that is so nice.
Thank you for another great report, Elizabeth. My late Auntie Phyllis, who once bought us an amaryllis, that rhymes, researched my mum's side of the family to try to prove that our ancestor was, on my mum's side, was the founder of the Quaker movement, George Fox. My uncle and grandfather were called George Fox, and the name goes back further in the family. She nearly proved it before she died. Have you got any interesting ancestors or family stories? Let us know in postbag. My lovely late wife Sheila once wrote to Margaret Thatcher suggesting recycling paper, bottles, etc. as she saw it done when we went to California, when a man with a van turned up and collected newspapers and bottles and cans, etc., in neat piles outside the house. Now, about 2 months after she wrote the letter, a long letter came back to her via the City Engineers Department in Coventry, saying recycling wasn't viable. Sometime after that, the People Party started in Cowden and Finham, later becoming the Green Party, so it became political, with a large hole the size of America appearing in the ozone layer, I think above Antarctica. People started to become very concerned about the future of the planet, and votes were in it, and so Coventry Council took up recycling, providing householders with different coloured bins. Graham is now concerned about the latest plans to have yet more bins, but will they be confusing to visually impaired people? Here's Graham.
Well, I'm totally bemused by the item about the government changing the rules for refuse collection on the magazine recorded the 14th of January. It sounds awfully complicated to me. I still don't understand what's supposed to go in each bin. And how is a visually impaired person supposed to identify for the different bins if you can't see the colours? At the moment, I use a small bin for my gardening waste, a large bin for my ordinary household waste. Actually, it ought to be the other way around, really. and I use plastic bags for my recycling, which the council provide for me. If I'm going to have a fourth bin, I don't know how I'm going to work out how to identify them. I thought the government was going to make the refuge collection more simplified. Instead of that, it looks like they're going to make it more difficult.
So, have you any thoughts on the variety of bins you are expected to put your rubbish in and then put them out on the pavement? Let us know. Now, we are getting very short of postbag messages. There's lots of things you can talk about. Little helpful tips that have helped you in life with a visual impairment. You can pass on, where you're going for your holiday. What sort of hobbies you've got. What have you been doing lately? Just let us know. Okay, thank you very much. There's that phone number again, 02476 717 522, and press 5 for Coventry Talking Newspaper and start speaking. But there's other ways as well. There's the sending a letter written by you or someone on your behalf. You can send me an email if you want, davidmonks46@gmail.com, and basically there's lots of ways. Thank you very much indeed. Okay, and bye for now.
This is Outlook. You can contact Postbag.
Our website is www.talkingnewspaper.org.uk. Our email address is postbag@talkingnewspaper.org.uk. Join in the discussion on Postbag.
A big thank you to Dave for this week's Postbag. Please do keep those contributions coming. And now here's Elaine to tell us all about the village of Priors Hardwick in South Warwickshire.
In common with many ancient villages, Hardwick's beginnings remain obscure. It can, however, be said with certainty that Hardwick, in the Hundreds of Honesbury, was one of 24 vills with which Earl Leofric endowed the monastery, which he founded in Coventry sometime before 1043. Hardwick is also recorded in the Domesday Book. Sometime before the dissolution of the monasteries, the village was destroyed, with subsequent depopulation. The destruction was probably ordered by the Prior of Coventry to provide solitude for the monks and grazing for the flocks of sheep introduced to cater for the wool and meat markets. The site of the deserted village lies behind St Mary's Church in the field known as Farm Close. The fish ponds are still discernible, together with several house platforms and a number of hollow ways. After the dissolution of the monasteries, Sir Edmund and Lady Ursula Knightley were granted the manor. Repopulation began in the late 16th century on the fringes of the former village. There were at least 20 holders of lands in the parish at this time. They farmed in the open fields, growing barley, oats, wheat, peas, hay and hops, and grazing cattle, horses and sheep. That the Rainbows, Wilkshires, Gubbins, Shirleys and their neighbours must have worked so hard to survive on the heavy clay soil goes without saying. How they took their leisure, if indeed they had any, remains to be discovered. Spice must surely have been added to the life of the village by the visits of lively Welsh drovers as they progressed on their way to and from the London markets with their herds of cattle, sheep, pigs or flocks of geese. The ancient salt road, used for carrying salt and other commodities from Droitwich to Northampton, would doubtless have brought travellers into the settlement. The old system of open field farming was brought to an end in 1767, with an Act of Parliament dividing and enclosing the land. With the planting of quickthorn hedges to enclose the various parcels of land, the present patterns of fields began to take shape. From 1869 on into the early 1900s, several small farms were sold and acquired by one family, marking the beginning of the trend which eventually led to the amalgamation of the majority of land in the parish to form just three farms. One can imagine the effect on the community of the murder of Betsy Handcock. On the night of the 13th of November 1872, she was stabbed by her husband, the local pig butcher. Edward Handcock earned himself the dubious distinction of being the last man hanged in Warwick Gaol. About 172 people lived in the village in 2020. The school closed in 1959. And the children now depart daily by bus or car to other places. The vicarage has been sold, and the vicar now lives in Priors Marston. The village has no shop or post office, although there is a pub with a restaurant, and the beautiful old church of St Mary's. The post office closed in 1993, after Mrs Wynne had run it for 40 years and 3 months. Residents see Hardwick as a tranquil place in which to live, far removed from urban activity, providing solitude without isolation. Only a handful of people find a livelihood in the community. Incomes are earned in surrounding towns. But in an ever-changing world today, sheep still graze in Priors Hardwick.
Thanks, Elaine. Next week, she's back in South Warwickshire at another prior, Priors Marston. Now, Coventry's very light railway. Nigel examines whether the delay in the Leeds tram service may have implications for Coventry.
As recently as June 2025, the Chancellor, the Transport Secretary and Tracy Brabin, Mayor of West Yorkshire, publicly committed £2,500 billion to the Leeds tram scheme. However, just before Christmas, the Department for Transport quietly postponed the scheme until the late 2030s. The proposal involved two lines, one linking Bradford and Leeds, and another running through Leeds city centre between a major hospital and a retail park. The Treasury, having been badly burned by the mounting costs of HS2, is now particularly reluctant to commit billions to major transport projects. Even announcements of politically significant schemes, such as Northern Powerhouse Rail, have been repeatedly postponed throughout 2025. They are always expected soon. In Leeds, one reason for the delay is the absence of a business case. The government's new advisory body, NISTA, the National Infrastructure and Service Transformation Authority, requires an initial business case before authorising further work. Ironically, local authorities cannot produce such a case without government approval to spend the money needed to do so. A business case must clearly identify the problem the scheme is intended to solve. For trams, this is usually reducing congestion and improving connection between communities. In Leeds, the tram routes were to be at the heart of an integrated transport network with the region's buses, which are being brought under local authority control. Business cases test out proposals, but since they can have two or three stages, they can have the effect of slowing down approval, often beyond the life of a parliament. Thus, projects can time out, which might be the fate of the Leeds scheme. But what does this mean for Coventry? Coventry is about to see its second demonstration trial of very light rail. These trials aim to show that cheaper infrastructure is possible, using shallow trenching for tracks and crossings and lightweight tram vehicles. If successful, this will reduce costs and strengthen a future business case. However, Coventry Council and VLR promoters have yet to clearly define the main problem the scheme is meant to solve. The original proposed route from the railway station through the city centre and Poole Meadow bus station to University Hospital could plausibly have reduced congestion and improved access across a large section of the city. More recent discussions, however, have focused on linking the station to Green Power Park, the soon-to-close airport. Based on the prospect of 8,000 future jobs linked to a battery gigafactory and advanced manufacturing. At present, those jobs do not exist. Until real investment and employment are in place, this represents a serious, possibly fatal, weakness in any VLR business case. The government is not currently committed to a Coventry VLR. What exists are incremental demonstration trials of national significance, not a funded transport project. Coventry VLR does not feature in the national infrastructure pipeline, unlike schemes such as the Midland Metro Digbeth extension, the Tyne and Wear Metro extension, or the now-delayed West Yorkshire Tram. Many of these are themselves pushed back to the mid or late 2030s. That said, other cities will be watching Coventry closely. If the trials prove that cheaper track construction and lightweight vehicles will work at scale, these innovations could be adopted elsewhere. That would reduce costs, strengthen business cases, and make tram schemes more attractive to a sceptical Treasury. As Leeds has shown, the local context for a VLR scheme will also need to be established. How would a VLR fit into any future land use and transport strategy for Coventry? There is a brief mention of rapid transport, including VLR, in the council's draft local plan, but no formal policies for it, and there is no definition of any route in the council's transport strategy. Will there be a public transport system integrating trams, buses and trains, together with cycling and walking? Finally, if a business case is made for Coventry VLR at some future date, will such a case still have support from any new government? So, will Coventry get a VLR? Well, only if, one, the trials clearly demonstrate that infrastructure and vehicles are much cheaper than conventional tram schemes, and two, a credible business case can be made for a route to Green Power Park, supported by real investment and real jobs.
Thanks, Nigel. And now the second part of Blinded by a Horse. After a life-changing injury, Catherine Robinson now plans to become a Paralympian. This is written by Andrea Busfield and is taken from the Daily Express. It's read again by Margaret.
This week we also took a walk around the farm, going over gates, not opening them, climbing over electric fences, walking through the river so I can hear the sound of the water. As Jack holds Catherine's hand as she learns to navigate her new landscape, Melissa has already set her sight on her friend's future, launching an online fundraiser to help her boss rebuild her life. At first I wasn't keen on the idea, but it's been incredible. Not just the donations, but the messages, admits Catherine. People have been so kind. Even my mum and dad love reading the comments. Her next surgery will focus on rebuilding her shattered cheekbone and eye sockets with plates, followed by reconstructive work on her right eye to preserve its appearance. They can do amazing things now, she says. It might not see, but hopefully it'll still look like an eye. If her injuries sound overwhelming, Catherine's determination eclipses them. Within days of leaving the hospital, she was walking around the fields to visit the horses. I just needed to see them. Well, not see, but be with them, she smiles. I gave them a cuddle and it felt right again. And she had told Jack she wanted to ride in the Paralympics. Amazingly, just 3 weeks later, she's already talking about training for paradressage, the discipline in which visually impaired riders compete, using callers who guide them through the arena with verbal cues. It's going to be tough. I get frustrated easily, but I need something to aim for, she says. When I was in hospital, I said, I think I want to go to the Olympics, and that's what I'm sticking with. Despite the trauma, Catherine speaks with humour and composure, more concerned about others than herself. I told Jack to go back to work this week because I don't want everyone fussing over me, she laughs. I'm independent. I know I'll need help, but I want to do as much as I can myself. Those who know her aren't surprised. Catherine left school at 16 to work in a racing yard near Belfast, where she stayed for 14 years riding everything from young eventers to jumpers before moving to England to train under event rider Jodie Amos. She spent 3 years at Amos's prestigious Aston Lawalls yard in Daventry, Northants, before setting up her own operation. With the support of friends Mark and Emily Warner, she transformed an old cattle shed on their farm into a purpose-built stable block, a base for her growing young horse business. They've been a great help getting me started and getting going, she says. Nearly 2 years on, her business, Catherine Robinson Braking and Schooling, has proved a commercial success. And despite the devastating injuries she suffered, Her love of the beautiful colts and fillies she trains means she holds no resentment towards the animal that blinded her. Horses are unpredictable, but that's never their fault, she says. It wasn't a bad horse, it was just a moment. I've had so many good ones, I could never blame them. While Catherine was offered help and counselling from the NHS in the aftermath of the accident, she declined the offer, feeling no need for the assistance at the present, beyond the advice she will soon receive from her local association of the blind. They will be the ones to train her how to use a stick and also prepare her for the possibility of introducing a guide dog at some stage. And when I wake up, open my eyes, and there's nothing but darkness, I do think, well, this is my life now, Catherine admits. But I can't say it's an oh God moment or that I have found it overwhelming. I might do at a later stage, but life has been quite hectic since the accident with all the appointments and visits. Last night, in fact, was the first time I had a moment that felt normal. My parents are here and we put a film on. I could follow by listening and with Jack talking me through the action, and it felt really nice, really normal. When she's fully healed, Catherine plans to start gentle physical therapy and orientation training to adapt to her blindness, but her ultimate goal remains to get back in the saddle. They said I should wait 6 to 8 weeks before doing anything close contact, she grins, but I'm thinking that maybe after 3 I can just have a little sit, see how it feels. Her optimism is contagious. It'll just be a different way of experiencing things, she says. When you love horses, you don't stop loving them because you can't see them. Catherine and Jack had planned to travel to Australia in January, a trip now postponed but not cancelled. We'll go, she says firmly, just later. You can't plan everything in life, can you? Her GoFundMe page has already raised more than £100,000, money that will go towards specialist mobility training, adaptive equipment, and perhaps one day the horse that carries her into a Paralympic arena. I've had my life turned upside down, Catherine says, but I'm still here. I've got amazing people around me, and I've got horses. That's enough.
A remarkable lady. Now the fantasy opera. Elaine tells us all about Ravel's one-act opera, The Child and the Spells.
In a large room overlooking a garden, a little boy of 6 or 7 sits in front of his school books, surrounded by familiar things. The grandfather clock, the squirrel in its cage, the cat. The boy stares at his homework, but he would rather misbehave than study. The door opens and his mother enters, carrying his tea on a tray. Has mother's boy been good and finished his lesson? She notices the ink-stained carpet under his feet and the unfinished lesson on the table, and she scolds him for his laziness. When she asks for an apology, the unrepentant boy sticks out his tongue. Here's food for a naughty child. Tea without sugar and dry bread. You'll stay alone till dinner and think about how sad you've made me. The furious child throws a temper tantrum. He knocks his cup and teapot off the table, opens the cage and pricks the squirrel with his pen, pulls the cat's tail and stirs up the fire with a poker, sending a cloud of ash and smoke into the room. Hurrah! He shouts, stabbing the little shepherds and shepherdesses on the wallpaper with the hot poker. Large sections tear away from the wall. Hurrah! He howls again, swinging on the pendulum of the grandfather clock. But he isn't satisfied till he rips his books to pieces. No more lessons, no more homework. I'm free, naughty and free. The wicked boy flops into an easy chair, but it collapses beneath him. Then, to his utter amazement, the armchair comes magically to life and creeps away like a giant toad. "Now we're forever rid of this child with his horrid heels," the armchair says to a little Louis XV chair. In chorus, the bench, sofa, ottoman and wicker chair all agree. No more of that child. Suddenly, Grandfather Clock chimes in. "I no longer know the time. He has broken my pendulum." Grandfather Clock careers about the room and turns his face to the wall to hide his shame. The boy can barely catch his breath, so astonished is he. The cracked black Wedgwood teapot rights himself and asks the chipped Chinese cup to dance to a jazzy foxtrot. Then, brandishing his fists, he growls at the boy. "I box you, sir. I marmalade you." The setting sun casts a pink glow into the enchanted room. Fearfully, the boy approaches the fireplace to warm himself. But fire leaps out and chases the boy around the room. "I warm the good, but burn the bad. Foolhardy little savage. You've insulted all the friendly household gods," trills the fire. Cinder follows in her footsteps, gently extinguishing the dancing flames. Shadows haunt the walls and ceiling of the room, and the boy whispers, "I'm afraid." Shy giggles reach his ears. The characters from the torn wallpaper spring to life, and the shepherds and shepherdesses mourn the loss of their nursery tale existence. Ungrateful child, who has slept while our blue dog, violet goat and pink sheep kept watch over him. Weeping, the boy lies on the floor, his face buried in the pages from a torn and abandoned storybook. A golden-haired princess rises from a page, the heroine of a fairy tale. "Help! Sleep and night want to take me," she cries, as the floor opens beneath her and she slips away. In a small, clear voice, the child grieves for the little princess. In vain, he leafs through the scattered pages to find the end of the story, and in frustration kicks his arithmetic book. Angry voices screech at him, and numbers fly out from between the pages, hovering menacingly over his head. A little old man emerges from the book, and tapping a ruler on the floor in time to the music, reels off mathematical problems. "Oh, my goodness! It's Father Arithmetic," cries the horrified child. In a falsetto voice, the little old man chants the arithmetic tables at an ever-increasing rate, while the numbers force the child into a frenzied dance. When at last his tormentors disappear, the dizzy boy falls to the floor. The moon rises, illuminating a wall of the room. The black cat creeps out from under the armchair and casts a shadow over the child's head. "Is that you, Kitty? You can speak too, no doubt." Black cat hisses. When a white cat perches on the windowsill, black cat leaves the boy to dance with her. Purring flirtatiously, they leap into the garden. The boy is about to follow them through the open window when the walls of the room dissolve and he is transported into the moonlit garden. Mysterious music rises, mimicking the buzzing of insects the muttering of frogs, the screech of owls, and the song of nightingales. The boy tries to lean against his favourite tree, but it groans. My wound! It's still bleeding sap from the knife cut you made in my side. Dragonflies flutter overhead. One alights beside the boy, demanding to know the whereabouts of his companion. Ashamed, the child reveals that the insect is pinned to his bedroom wall. A bat scolds the boy for killing his mate with a stick the night before, leaving a nest full of little ones with no mother. Aghast at the results of his cruelty, the child begs for forgiveness. A frog hops onto the boy's lap and rests there. From a high branch, a squirrel looks down and warns the frog to stay away from such a dangerous child, a boy who imprisons squirrels in cages and takes away their freedom. Other squirrels jump down from the tree and dance in the moonlight. Bats swoop, moths flutter, cats play, frogs leap, and the child suddenly realizes that he is alone and forgotten. They all love each other, they're happy, but I'm alone. Mama! The boy's cry upsets the delicate balance in the garden. Enraged, the trees and animals surround the child, and in a thundering chorus they list their grievances. Then, clawing and scratching, they attack him. In the confusion, the animals turn on one another, and the injured boy lies forgotten in a corner. Near him, a squirrel licks his bleeding paw. The child takes a ribbon from his neck, binds up the wound, and then collapses. Awestruck, his adversaries gather around him. He has dressed the wound. He is wise, observes an owl. He has stopped the bleeding. He is good, comments a nightingale. With this kind act, the boy proves that he is capable of good, and the animals decide to make amends. As the dragonflies fan him with their wings, the other animals lift the child and carry him to the house. Let's take him back to his nest. That's where we'll find help for the wounded child. They imitate his cry of Mama, and a light appears in the window. The animals, though reluctant to leave their new friend, bound away. Radiant in the moonlight, the child holds out his arms and calls, Mama! And the curtain falls on the fantasy opera. So maybe the moral of the tale is, do as you would be done by.
Thank you, Elaine. Now we hear from Dave on his visit to explore the Coventry Music Museum, where he met the very imaginatively named group, Flat Badger.
Coventry Music Museum, which is found at the top of Bull Hill, it covers all types of music, starting from the Roman music, with a tiny bell used for ceremonial purposes. On the left-hand side, as you walk into Coventry Music Museum, there's the piano used by the mum of Rob Woodward, Hilda, of the group Lieutenant Pigeon, that had a number one in 1972 for 4 weeks. Welcome to Coventry Music Museum.
You remember the record, Mouldy
O'Dowd? Yeah.
Well, this is the piano.
That they use?
Yeah, they use, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I say.
Excellent. And that was recorded in Kingsway.
Yeah.
Near here.
Yeah.
Was it?
Yeah, it was near.
That was the mother, the one of the sons, that was the mother who played the do. Yeah.
And oh, the old do. So that was quite fascinating, but on the right hand side there's a music room where you could have a go at various instruments, and including a theremin, which I showed to Elizabeth of the Monday Club on her visit there.
That's fantastic!
There you are. Great stuff.
What, did you know this place existed?
Yes. And this, what's known as a pheromone here. Can you hear it?
Yeah.
There's an aerial standing up which you put your hands around, but you don't exactly touch. And you get various sounds out of it.
Hey, Cracker! Hey!
Here we are. You see? It's very difficult to get a tune out of it, but it has been done, I believe.
Wow!
And the actual stairs you climb up have got a keyboard pattern on it, on the carpet, which is really nice. And right up here, there's the actual car used in the video Ghost Town. This town coming like a ghost town. Yes, the specials.
Wow!
Yes. You see? And you can sit in that and be picture taken. Okay, we have the record My Ding-a-ling by Chuck Berry. Now,
well, my main claim to fame is that I was there when he actually recorded it.
And you sang on My Ding-a-ling.
It was actually recorded in Coventry. And then I can't hear ballroom.
Great stuff.
When I was a teenager.
So you've sung on a number one record.
I didn't realise that, but I did.
There was memorabilia around the museum to many Coventry-born stars. And one of them was Frank Ifield, whom I interviewed once.
How do you feel about your name being up on the wall in the Coventry Music Museum in the two-town square there? You've been there today, haven't you?
Yes, I was, and I really did enjoy that because we had a nice crowd of people, and a lot of them I hadn't met before, and we sat down, we chatted about things, you know, and it was good. Yes, and I'd rather enjoy the fact that, you know, I'm recognised in my own home territory. That's great. Even though I only spent 3 years of my life here, I still am a Coventry kid.
I will tell them I
This is a white circular bench, a replica of John and Yoko's bench. They planted two acorns in the middle of it. Yeah, they did, for peace. And they wanted to exhibit it in an art exhibition at Coventry Cathedral, but they got a bit sniffy and they went away in a huff, you see. But this is a replica of that bench. But actually, when Yoko Ono came to Coventry, she sat on it, you see. I spoke to the curator, Pete Chambers, BEM, who, along with his wife Julie, founded the Coventry Music Museum. And people still come from all over the world to the Coventry Music Museum.
Yeah, we've got some, actually, as you, funny you should say that, we've got three Italians in here at the moment.
Italians! And Pete Chambers had invited two members of Coventry group Flat Badger to entertain and relate their stories, whom I spoke to.
Yeah.
as your member of Flat Badger.
Oh, yes.
What's your name?
Eddie.
Eddie. How did Flat Badger, the name, come about? Was it the obvious, like, Flat Hedgehog?
Yeah, I used to work on a farm. I'd see them after they'd had an argument with agricultural equipment, and I thought, yeah, there's a name for a band.
Good name. Thank you. Good sound as well. We enjoyed it, didn't we, Lee?
Fantastic morning. Wow, yes, I am impressed. What a boy. He deserves to go places.
And this is what we'll say. If you please one person in the audience, it's a success.
Yeah, can I have a word with you, please? The Talking Newspaper. Josh, isn't
yes,
it?
Yes, yeah, yes.
Okay, so have you enjoyed coming to the Coventry Music Museum?
Yeah, I had a great time. I think that Pete Chambers does a great thing here, and also all the volunteers that help out here as well. Yeah, I think it's a beautiful thing, isn't it, that it's been open this long and it's still up and running, and it's because of all their hard work, and they make things like this possible, so it's really, really nice.
Well, the Coventry Music Museum is open from Thursdays to Sundays. On Thursday to Saturday it's 10 a.m. till 4 p.m. and on Sunday it's 10 a.m. till 3 p.m. So did you enjoy your look around the music museum?
Fantastic. Elizabeth? Fantastic, yeah. Day. Very enjoyable.
Okay.
Certainly was.
Thank you, and that's all from the Coventry Music Museum, from myself, Dave Monks, and from Elizabeth.
Elizabeth.
Bye.
Bye.
And that visit from Dave brings us to the end of this week's Outlook. So from me and the rest of the team, it's goodbye for another week.